letter J.
Letter J?
Mm-hmm.
Why not I?
Yes, I. Yes.
You can just tell me the letter J.
Thank you.
In fact, we'll write it down in three forms. This is in response to Goethe's determination to get to the meaning of the alphabet. You all know she's a great Greek scholar and has detected something of the significance of the 12 basic consonants and the 5 vowels of the name of God. We have done one of the letters before, but for some reason we're jumping from that one to the letter J. We look at it in three forms, and I've written it I, Y, and J, because these are three levels of difficulty of the same letter. All these letters in the Hebrew are written simply as a little dot, like a comma. That's the Hebrew letter Yud. And it is the same as the English word jot. It is the iota of the Greek, and it means quite simply a point. We draw a point very carefully and write its name under it, and then we'll proceed to analyze what a point is, and then we'll say how this is related to the letter J, Y, and I. A point, if we divide it in the appropriate manner, is a power in crucifixion. Po in T. The PO is, of course, the root of power. It's the root of push. And this power entering into a cross situation establishes itself as a point. The letter Yod has a sort of comma appearance about it, which is all that remains of an original spiral form. The force of infinity is winding itself in and poticing itself in as compact a form as it can, so that we can imagine the field of sentient power simply twisting inwards and bringing into being, by its act of twisting, a centre. And this centre is simply a power self-crucified, a power driving in from the field to a centre and pinning itself in this centre. Now, if we remove all the points from the universe, we have removed all discrete bodies, whatever. We remove basic electrons, neutrons, protons, mesotrons, barotrons, and all the others that go with them. All discrete bodies, whatever, come under the category of points of reference. And all points are simply powers in crucifixion, powers fixed as they cross. Crucifixion means simply one force is going along and another force is going along in another direction, and at some point they intersect. The power of the one affects the power of the other, and where two powers cross, they come into opposition, and the result is a rotation. That zone of rotation is a power in a zone of crossing. It is a point. It is represented by the letter I, Y, and J, which is the same letter in the Hebrew, the Yod. Now, this Yod letter, if we observe in German, as in Hebrew, you pronounce the letter J as if it were an English letter Y. You say Yod for that, not Jod. And if we said Yod, we would observe a thing about it immediately, that the first part of the word, the first two letters, the Y-O or the J-O or the E-O, all mean God. One of the oldest forms we have of the name of God is simply the double vowel E-O, and E, the vowel E, written in English I, and we must beware of English vowels because they're largely diphthongs, they're not pure. We must learn to think in continental vowels as in French or German or Italian. We put a dot on the paper to represent the E, and we draw a circle round it to represent the O. And we pronounce this word, the dot in the circle, yo, as in yo-yo, which is derived from the same source, like all games are derived from basic mythic propositions. And this means each for the dot and all for the circle. So the glyph yo means each and all. And this means God as creator of macrocosmos and God as creator of all individual points within it. So the first part of the yod, the yot or the yota, means God as source of all and each. It is the absolute creative force. And the T following it, or the D, simply means, in the case of the T, crucifixion, the point where one force hits another and establishes a point. So the word yot means God crucified. The word yot with a Y means God crucified. The word yod with a J, pronounced like a hard Y, means God divided. Now the T has become D. D means division. Now why does D mean division and T mean crucified? Because D vision is the kind of vision we have when we cut a whole circle in half. We get duality out of the simple vision of looking at two halves and parting these two halves with a knife. This is D vision. But within the field of force as we know it, represented by the paper and the paper ripples, we draw the marks of the ripples travelling over the paper, and we see that they produce points of intersection of ripples or forces, and the division or the vision of duality depends entirely upon the generation of intersection points. So if forces did not intersect, there would be no centers of vortical action, no spinning points, no finites, no individuated existences. But if these points come into existence, then we can have these stance. We can stand in two places at once. You can put your right foot on one of these dots and your left foot on the other, and you can feel the strain between your legs when the points are wide apart, and you call this sensation a strain. This stance means standing in two places at once. If you spread two of your fingers very, very hard and feel the strain between them, you'll understand that all distance implies strain, just as all unity of integrated form implies stress. Every single point of intersection of forces is a generation of an individuated being. We say that this letter I or Y or J is simply the glyph for a point. That is for the center of inwinding of the field force of the absolute. And the field force has created itself into a center. This is very important to understand, because if we don't, we will think there is injustice in the world. If this paper represents all there is, and the paper is rippling, it is the paper that is doing the rippling. It is acting, and it is paying the price of its own action. If I get a friend to shake the bottom and I shake the top, to illustrate the fact that it can shake itself anywhere, because it can shake itself in any given place. If it can shake itself in one place, it must be able to shake itself in all places, because it is a continuum. And the qualities of a pure continuum are throughout the same. So if at a given point it can rise and fall, then at any other point, likewise, it can rise and fall. But wherever it rises and falls, it is itself at that point rising and falling. It is itself initiating an act. So that if this point over here on the sinister side is busy rising and falling, And the part on the next side also begins to rise and fall. It resisted me like that, like most exercises do. Then, in the act of the dexter resisting the action of the sinister sometimes is led to complain about this. And it says, something is happening here on the sinister side of this paper that the sinister side is not initiating. And this is the ground of its belief in injustice. Perhaps the sinister side, or left wing, is vibrating very weakly. And the dexter side, if I can catch it, is vibrating very strongly. And the ripples from the dexter side are going over to the sinister side and inhibiting or imposing upon it a pattern that it itself has not initiated. Because the sinister side has not initiated this motion, then it says it is injustice. Which means it didn't start it. It is simply suffering the consequences of action initiated outside its own centre. But every centre within the field is a centre of initiation and is totally responsible for its own action, whether that action is an original act of initiation or a reaction to another action initiated in another centre. So if Billy Brown does something and Johnny Smith does something else, that Billy Brown doesn't like, Billy Brown's complaint about Johnny Smith is not absolutely valid. It's a purely subjective point of view. He has no ultimate ground of complaint because he exists. And in order to exist, he has to place himself in existence. In other words, if we didn't exist, we'd have no ground to complain. And if we do complain, we necessarily exist. But the ground of our existence is our will to exist. Let's have a look what existence means. The whole of the field is represented by the paper. As the paper is waving about, the ripples upon it are producing the pattern we know so well, the pattern of intersecting circles. And these circles could be drawn all over the paper, so that we can draw, if we like, circles from any given point to any other point. Now each circle has a centre of initiative. And wherever the centres are, they are responsible for what happens from that centre. Now, it is obvious that if any given centre, we'll say centre A, sends a ripple from itself, it would travel to infinity. In fact, it does travel to infinity. If there were no other impulse centres transmitting, it would dominate infinite space itself by its own motion. But, as we've seen, because motion can be initiated at any point whatever in the infinite sentient power, therefore it can be initiated in any other point too. So if point A initiates a motion to spread out through infinity, it means that other centers might do the like. And we will say for a moment, that is another point doing it. Point B is likewise spreading out to infinity. Now point B has no jurisdiction whatever over point A, at the point A. It only has it where B is. B is a centre of initiative. A is another centre of initiative. A has no jurisdiction over B, and B has none over A. And therefore, the centres of will appear to each other to be entirely arbitrary, which they are. But when they will in this manner, they always produce a zone of influence between them which is contested by the motions initiated by both. So between any two points we have a zone of turbulence kept in being by those two points. If either of the points dominates the whole zone, that is, if the motions initiated by that point, we'll say point B, if they are so strong that to all practical observation it appears that only B is there and not A, through the tremendous activity of B, A has no form of complaint that can possibly justify itself, because A is a centre of the same continuum that B is. So that A, in being in this sense subordinate to B, has nobody but itself to blame, ultimately. It is a center within the same continuum. And if it is acting in an inferior manner to B, then it is A's responsibility for self-acting. It has viewed reality in its own way from its own center, and it has responded in its own way, and it is responsible for its own activity and for the reaction of other beings upon it. It has nobody to blame but itself for existing in the first place. To exist is to introduce into the infinite field of the absolute a superstress. We've seen that we can draw all these circles through infinite space, and that each of these circles is an individual when viewed at a perimeter at any given distance from the center. Now, we can draw these perimeters as close as we like to the center. If we draw one fairly near to a center, we will say that the perimeter we have drawn would appear to have been driven back from another center, so that the center C may be smaller, and the radius from center C may be smaller than the radius from center B, in which case it appears that B is dominating, pushing A or C in. But in fact it is C or A giving in when B is pushing. They don't have to give in. They have the same authority from the continuum base common to them all that every other center has. So if they do give in, there is nobody to blame other than the giving in centers. They have the power and the right and the intelligence, if they will, to disagree, each from its own center. Now, we're talking about the letter J or Y or I. We're seeing that it means a point, that this point means a power in a state of crucifixion, and that this sentient power of the absolute is what we call God. And therefore, where any point exists, we see a point of crucifixion of God. In this sense, the concept of the crucified Christ, crucified on the cosmos, as an existential fact, prior to the temporal crucifixion of Christ in the time process, there is already a macrocosmic crucifixion by the simple fact of existing at all. To exist is to will to superstress a finite form within the infinite. Excess, if we remember, is the Latin for out, and the cis function existere means out of six, and the six is the wheel with its six spokes, and the six spokes are simply the radial functions of the six centers that are struck round any circle when you shift your compass from a center to the perimeter and continue to strike your circle. So to exist is to be a wheel, a six-fold being. Now, this can only happen by superstress within the infinite. The infinite contains absolutely all forms of individuation whatever as an absolute and eternal dynamic fact. But at the absolute level they are not superstressed, and therefore they are not serialized and temporalized. They are an eternal, absolute, simultaneous formal actuality of the supreme sentient power. But as soon as the superstress is placed at any point whatever within the infinite, the responsibility for the superstress is where the superstress is. The superstress is not imposed by one being on another, it is imposed by that being upon itself. To come to exist in the first place is an act of will from the infinite into the superstress state. We can see that if we draw all the circles all over, they all exist. When they are stressed individually beyond the level of the absolute. If we now draw on the circles and then we deliberately start counting them, say one circle, two circle, three circle, four, five, we are serializing these ourselves by deliberately concentrating on portions of this symbolic diagram. All these circles are on the paper now at once. If I want to start writing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 on them, 6, 7, 8, 9, this takes what we call time. But all these things exist already. The time generation is my arbitrary act. I am generating time on what in effect is a simultaneous formal presentation in the diagram. And I do it by deliberately finiting my energy to one of the circles whilst I write in it at one. Then I shift my attention, that is, the tension of the superstress is shifted to another circle, and I write two. Then I forget one and think of two. Now I forget two, shift to the circle three and mark that. I forget three, shift to that and mark four. And so on. This way I can take time by simply concentrating on finite. Time is the product of the concentration on finite zones and the moving from finite zone to finite zone, abandoning one for the other as we go along. Time is serial presentation of what in fact absolutely is simultaneous and eternal. So that when we come to finite zone, we can say we are dealing with the meaning of the letter J. And we've written it as I, Y and J and said it is the same letter. Let us see why we say it. The letter I, pronounced in languages other than English as E, rather long in the word bit. If you said beat instead of bit, that would be the sound, and the E in bit is simply a short E. Like in beat, as in downbeat, root beat, and so on. Now the vowel E, written English I, is pure, uninterrupted sound coming out. Because it is uninterrupted, we say it is a vowel sound. The word vowel, sound shift B to V, is a vowel sound. It is a sound coming out of the vowels without interruption from any part of the vocal apparatus. So in its pure form, the vowel E signifies an uninterrupted point, a point that is not being impeded in any way. And when we say the letter Y, which is written in the same way, we say yeah. We have a little strain on it. We lift the tongue up in a certain way. We use a certain amount of pressure to say ye that we don't use to say e. E is a simple flow of the breath through the mouth. The tongue is in a certain position, but the tongue makes no effort in the enunciation. So we say that the vowel E is a sound signifying an uninterrupted point, but the consonantal form written with Y is simply E with a little effort on it, ye. We press the tongue in a certain way, and that adds effort. So we say the letter Y means the affirmation, that little bit of effort, ye. That energy applied to the point symbolized by the vowel. The vowel E is a point without effort, a free point. The vowel Y is the same point with a certain amount of effort on it. It is being affirmed, it is the superstress of the first order. And the consonantal form written with J, pronounced in English as a J, could equally well be written D, E, A. The English word die, D-A, J. And now this is a superstress of the second order. And it implies that the effort of Y has now gone to such a level that it becomes die, die. This means it has actually divided. The pure vowel E has now become divided. So the same symbol has three pronunciations. Let's write three levels of E. E, Y, J. You see the Welsh philosopher is at the bottom again. The vowel E at the top is simply an uninterrupted point and symbolizes intellection. The consonantal form written with a Y, Y, symbolizes an emotional pressure, feeling pressure, a slight superstress of the feeling, but the sound J, which is harder still, symbolizes the beginning of a dividing process. So we can say this is three levels, because in this hard J you can hear the D. The final thing, of course, is when you split the D and write the word dead for it instead. That's the fourth phase of it, the complete severance of the parts positive. We can say then that the same symbol, the letter Yod or the Yotta, symbolizes three different levels of being according to whether we are aware of the principle of free spirit or the presence of a feeling stress upon that, a superstress of the feeling order, then a superstress of the physical order, the jiv sound, and then finally the disintegration of the physical order, the dead sound. It is really all the same sound pronounced with varying degrees of difficulty.
Can you affirm without dividing?
Can you affirm without dividing? Yes. You can do so because you are aware in your body of slight differences of pressure that do not in fact amount to severance of center from center. If you like to clench your hand, you can feel where your fingers press the palm, and you can feel a little bit further away from the tips of the finger, round the fingers to the back, and feel where the palm is being pressed by the fingers. And you can be aware of the continuity of this, so the stress is simply at the two ends of a continuous feeling. So you can affirm a duality which is not a duality, in the sense that the two ends of a stick belong to a unity. If I get hold of this pencil, which we will say is one, ignoring molecular theory or anything else, here is one pencil held between thumb and finger. I am pressing upon it, and I am feeling that it has two ends, but from the fact that these two ends are not compressible between my fingers without some degree of pain, I know that there is a continuity principle between them, a unity principle which I call the pencil. The two ends of the pencil I can experience without severing the unity of the pencil. This is again another illustration of the old Chinese statement. In dealing with the absolute, you cannot get rid of the other end of the stick. As soon as you define it all, you have made two ends. These two ends can be seen to be two ends, simply because when you are looking at any circumscribed thing, whatever, there is always a duality of inner and outer. But there is no suggestion here of severance, no separability.
Inner and outer here wouldn't constitute a division.
Not strictly, no. If I draw the rod of the pencil, and then put a thumb on one side and a finger on the other side, and the connecting link between the two, when I press upon it, it resists back. And that I press and feel a sensation from the finger and from the thumb is the origin of my idea of duality, of ends. And that the resistance between them is there and in opposite directions is the ground of my belief in the unity of the pencil. So I do not have to sever the concept end from the concept pencil. In fact, I cannot sever the concept end from the concept pencil. In fact, I cannot sever the concept end, finite, finish, from any existential being, whatever. Every existential being is a unity with terms. And I cannot concretely sever the terms from the existence. The existence is a unity, and the terms of the existence are apparently a duality, but they are not a severable duality. It is abstract thought to consider it to be a severable duality.
How would you introduce D then, using the same analogy there? At what point would you introduce the concept of D?
By deliberately de-stressing the middle part of the pencil. It's abstract thought. We know that absolutely there is no separability because it is an absolute continuum.
Now, how does the Welsh philosopher department How is that doing that? How is that actually producing that defunction?
Well, first of all, he says, we'll say this to Tantrama, with Tantrama, on the works of philosophy's younger brother, he is saying, I believe I can push harder than index finger intellect. And in order to do this, if you get your pencil and press very hard with your thumb, you can see how easy it is to deceive yourself. You know very well that to every action there's an equal and opposite reaction. But if you get hold of your pencil and press very hard on the thumb side, you know that the finger opposite to it must be pressing at the same pressure. Otherwise you couldn't stabilize the pencil. But if you concentrate on the thumb side, it feels as if the thumb is winning the battle. Whereas if you concentrate on the other side and press the other way, you feel that the thumb might give in. So it depends entirely where you put the stress of your will, where you think the victory is going to be. So this question of the Welsh philosopher, of the J.T., which is the affirmer of the cross, is that he affirms a finite situation, identifies with a finite form, and then says, now from this centre I will give the orders to the universe. And this is what we mean by precisely this J.T. function. It affirms itself as the centre of order for any given situation.
Could you extend on the word vision with something on B to V and V and F, vision particularly, V?
Are we actually going beyond the letter I at the moment?
No, I don't think so.
Not very far. No, all right. We'll do it anyway. Just for fun. Here's our letter V. Now the letter V starts with the letter I at the bottom, which is the point from which all development must begin. The letter V is simply a drawing of the leaves of a plant or the forked tongue of a snake. It means two things. It means duality, the tongue of the asp, the one that bit Cleopatra, which means she had daddy's key in her pocket and didn't know how to use it, and the vegetable growth, the simple bifurcation of a force. So the letter V means to differentiate, to go from a point and spread out, and in the process of the spreading out, to pluralize. In fact, if you like to consider this V, it's simply an abstraction from the circle. 1/6 of the circle, if you like, will give you the letter V, the segment of it. Then we can see that the V Zion, or the heavenly development process, is simply that when we posit any point whatever, in the act of positing it, we have inwound into it the forces of the field. We have compressed into the point field potentials and made them invisible in the act of compressing them. That is to say, as soon as we move to impress, we take a field of potentiality, press it in, and in pressing it and reducing it, in its final term to a crystal, a gross mineral level, we have hidden all the dynamics of the field that has been compressed. And we've done this by a deliberate concentration on a point. By act of will, we have finited the potentials of a situation, and we have posited a point. Now, because we have wound it in from the absolute, therefore the field of the absolute is in this point. And therefore, if we start to define the point, or to divine the point, what we are actually doing is simply to describe the implications or infoldings of the meaning of point. That is to say, as soon as we take any point and define point, we are forced to define the field prior to the state of compression which generated the point. The implications or infolding of the field of potentials into the finite point the implied, the infolded, can be exfolded, can be explicated. And the explication of the implications of terms is the same thing as the return to the absolute which generated these terms. Now, term means an end, and in logic it means a special kind of tight definition. Simply means to define the thing till you can't define it any further. Not through personal incapacity to define, but because you have actually reached a limited definition for that thing. The limit of all definition at the small end is the word point. That is, the concept of point is the definition of energy driven in till all its potentials of form have become hidden in the supreme category of finite existence, signified by point. But as soon as you begin to define or divine, that is to develop the inner capacity, the unity of the thing, you analyze the unity, the analysis loosens by application of energy and motion, ana, loosens, analysis, loosens that which has been driven together, and you then proceed to explicate, to outfold that which was infolded. Now, when you define, V to F, define means intellectually state. The F is a non-substantial letter. It's a letter that we shouldn't be treating at the moment. It's a letter that signifies, because it is a letter that can be expressed without substantial voice. That is, you can whisper an F, you cannot whisper a V. You can whisper an F, and therefore it symbolizes a form which is non-substantial. Therefore it symbolizes an intellectual activity. To define is an intellectual activity. To divine is to become substantially aware of these same differences that were presented at the intellectual level as ideas, but at the divining level they are felt as actual movements of power expressing itself. You can do this with your own body much more easily by divination than by definition. To define, it is easier to divine. If you start with your physical body, you will always find in your physical body, if you feel for movement tendencies within the body, you will feel a certain state in the body which we call the tonic state of muscle tension. That is a tonic state throughout the body. This tonic state is the guarantee of your unity. The T1 in tonic means your unity principle, known whereby you are maintained as a being at all. This is your tonic, or fundamental number one. First harmonic, fundamental tonic tension in the body. The guarantee of your unity. It appears in the body as a tendency to move with any part of the body, with any organ of the body. The body is dynamic. This is the ground of the Nietzschean body wisdom. The body is trying to move. The civilized person can sit still, especially the English person. But the sitting still is an inhibition of the action potential of the organism. And in the act of sitting still, we lose the power to divine what is going on. Sitting still, we inhibit the body movement, we become unaware of the tendencies to action in the body, which are really responses to the field state of the environment. The body is aware from itself, the body is a compression of sentient power, it is aware in itself of tensions within an environment. And it tends, left to itself, in the uncivilized state, to adjust itself to these tensions. The body feels differently near a tree than it does in an open space. It can feel the field of the tree. It can feel the field of other human beings. It can feel the field of geological energies, of telluric forces emanating from the earth in different zones. It can, of itself, and without any training whatever, feel these things. This kind of feeling was deliberately suppressed by the ancients for a very, very special reason. Let's see what the reason was. If we did not have points of differentiation and individuation within the absolute, there would be only the absolute, and no individuals, and therefore no differences, no points of evaluation, no creation. To produce all that we mean by value, we must superstress. We must individuate. And to do this, we must, in the act of superstressing, in a certain sense, bind ourselves. Now, when we are absolutely field aware before creation, our sensitivity is so great that the slightest movement initiated in any part of the continuum is immediately transmitted to all parts of the continuum, and all parts of the continuum then, prior to creation, immediately adjust to this initiated action. In other words, they do not individuate. The whole absolute continuum is in a state of dynamic equilibrium, and this impedes the development of all that we call individual values. But it says God so loved the world. That is to say, he sees a value in the individuating process. Now, in order to individuate, we must cut down on this field awareness of the absolute initially. The way to do this is quite simply inhibit body movement. You notice that the child, when it's learning to write, writes not only with its pen and its hand, it writes with its tongue as well. And it writes with its whole body, it wriggles about like mad. And all its body is trying to write the letter B whilst the pen is trying to write the letter B. And very early in the civilized state, the child is forced to inhibit the body movement by its teachers, and to focus this movement on the end of the pen, until the child has ultimately become unconscious of the fact that its body as a whole was responding to the movement of its will to write the letter B. Now, this inhibiting of this body movement is the same thing as the creation of unawareness of body potential. So that in the process of inhibiting this body movement, the child gains a power to define a letter on the paper. But through the inhibiting of the body movement in the child, it has lost the power to divine what it means. So in the act of gaining the power of intellectual definition by inhibiting body movement, the human being has lost the power to divine, that is, to become aware of the potential of the field in which it is operating. And this was of necessity part of the evolutionary process. The intellect has a peculiar quality. It can produce an apparently static entity called unity or duality or trinity and so on. It can produce mathematical entities, it can produce geometrical entities, and it can so suppress the emotive charge on these things that they can actually be evaluated by a trained mathematician without any awareness of an emotional content. Now, this means a mathematician, a geometrician, can make judgments in no way biased by life. Life force is emotion. And if we inhibit all emotion, all life force, all movement of the body tissue and so on, we can, by this act of inhibition, define with an F, define the form of the situation without the substantial power of the situation. And this enables us to formulate quite emotionally unbiased judgments of events. We can make a mathematical, statistical analysis of the probability of the appearance of the common market. We can be wrong by ignoring the divining process or will to power in any given group of people. But we can actually make an unbiased mathematical geometrical analysis of any given situation. It has a utility. It enables us to abstract ourselves from the field and to mechanize our reactions. And in the act of mechanization, to create what we call an organ of thought. This organ of thought then to be so integrated that it becomes a permanent formal referent for the being that made it, without in any sense influencing the will of that being. If we can get a perfectly integrated logical form, any part of which presupposes all its parts, so the recall of any part recalls all of it, we have actually made for ourselves a permanent, unbreakable or immortal formal body, an intellectual body, which is called the subtle body in religion. This body has been gained, this intellectual body, has been gained at the expense of the loss of the power to divine. That is to say, to be aware of the tremendous forces of the environment actually influencing our body through protoplasmic sensibility. When there was a big earthquake in South America some years ago, 2 or 3 days before it happened, all the animals ran away, and the birds followed. The human beings there, who were intellectualized, had lost the power to divine and didn't know what was the matter with the animals until the earthquake banged off and the volcanic eruption jolted them into awareness that the animals had sensed something in the field that the intellectually stressed people had not been able to sense. Now, if we look at the word panic, which means what happens to a person when he becomes suddenly aware of all, the individual who panics has been concentrating upon a private purpose and suddenly becomes aware of forces beyond himself moving in another direction and about to refute his private purpose. This psychological state we call a panic fear. The goat-footed god of the Greeks symbolizes this fact as a peculiar animal drive of nature, which in a certain sense is not individuated like an intellectual is. And a man who can be privately working towards a certain end may become suddenly stimulated and made aware of forces beyond himself, and these forces entering into his consciousness cause in him that dreadful state we call panic. He runs about and he cannot do his work because of the panic. Now, this was known quite well to the Greeks, who were very intellectual. They were, if you like, superstressing a type of intellectual activity which later dominated Europe. They were disgusted with this field awareness that, as far as they were concerned, was anti-intellectual. They said this kind of thing interferes with our logic and must be stopped. And so they began an inhibiting process. Not that other nations hadn't begun it in smaller and more circumscribed ways, as in the yogis of India earlier. But they began it as a nation, and they spread it through Europe, that the man who is to be an individual with dignity and self-control must be a man with intellectual control such that he can stop this panic fear from getting hold of him. But the panic fear is simply field awareness of the potentialities lying beyond the individual that might defeat the individual in his private purpose. But the dignified, intellectually minded man said, "I fight against this field in order to individuate myself." Now, he had the backing of God behind him when he did it. That is to say, there is something in the absolute field aiming at individuation, aiming at the creation of individuals to become centers of finite awareness, because this way it pluralizes the values which would otherwise be simply the unific value of the field. By making a large number of individuated centers and pushing these centers along in the process we call evolution, to the point where they become reflexively aware of themselves as individuals and of themselves as centers within the field, centers of initiative, these individuals are pushed to the point where they become themselves creative centers. And this absolute infinite cannot fulfill its infinity of potentials without actually producing an infinity of centres of reference, each of which shall in due course be driven to the point of reflexive awareness, and thus enrich the value relations which would otherwise be merely a matter of a uniform field. So we see that here, when we define, we are doing an intellectual act only because we have managed to inhibit the body tendencies to respond to field forces. And when we do the act called divining, as in water divining and so on, or being a very good parson who knows the will of God, when we divine in this way, we are simply making ourselves aware of the plasmic changes of behaviour under the influence of field forces in the sentient part of the absolute. Now, if we change from F to V, we change from the intellectual level into the substantial plasmic level of the organism. If we change from V to B, we have now again done, as we did with T to D, we have entered the realm of severance. If we say F for an intellectual proposition, V for the affective state, and B for the bondage state, again, the letter B, as we've said, is a circle. The letter V breaks out from that circle, and the letter F desubstantializes that energy. Again, we have the three levels, and the sound shifts from the spirit by involution into bondage, from bondage by definition, we go out through the divining process, stating the implications that were involved in the bondage, as we did in the case of the implications of power in the point. We do both processes. St. Paul, considering this from the temporal end, and talking to temporally orientated people, said, first a physical body, then a spiritual body. When we come into the time process in a physical body as a child, we haven't enough awareness reflexively to be able to say to ourselves we are a spirit. We are so lacking in orientation that we are compelled by the environing forces of mother, father, educators and so on to identify with the physical body. It is the physical body that is potted, the physical body that is swaddled, physical body that is stuffed with food and so on from outside, that focuses the attention of the child at the material level. Otherwise the child wouldn't do it. So the external environment in the form of mother, father, etc., pressing on the child, reduces the child from a spiritual level through a feeling level into the physical identification. But when its physical identification is come into consciousness for the child as an individual, that is the first stage. It is the first stage of return. It is the last stage of involution. So the plan of the Gospel in John goes down and up in this way. In the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 is infinity. We go down from the unific spirit, that's like Taurus, winding in through Gemini and Cancer, down into the individuated self of the earth-born lion of the time process. You know, the lion symbolizes not only individuation, but also Saturn Kronos as the devourer of serial events. Number 4 is the square number and symbolizes the earth. We step down 3 steps, then the next step is onto the earth, and then we step off the earth 3 steps up to the sevenfold life of awareness at the highest level for an individual, beyond which there is only the eternal, absolute. This is the same kind of plan: involution, evolution, implication, explication. We can say this, that insofar as we understand terms, that is, symbols, the letters of the alphabet are only symbols, the language is only a symbolic structure, whatever the language is, it doesn't matter if it's English or Chinese or anything else, it is merely a symbol of a form of force. Language is a means of communicating. The lang, the ling in it, is the link which ties together that which has been severed. So that linkage or language is the means whereby we become aware of that which we have lost awareness of. We had absolute awareness, but prior to the individuated state we didn't know we had it. Now we're in a state of individuation, and we are trying to gain this absolute awareness that when we had it we didn't know we had it. Now we want to get it and know that we have it, and to do this we have to go through a series of steps. There is no better step for a human being than to become aware of the implications of the terms he uses, because the words, the symbols, are in fact precipitates at the intellectual level of power. Which means that if you take any intellectual proposition whatever and proceed to define it accurately on good philological principles, you will find for every constituent of that word, when you reduce it into the plasmic level, that it is an occasion of divination. The definition felt in the body as a movement tendency is the key to divination. That is to say, the man can become divine, able to contact again this absolute field, by analyzing his terms, reducing them to their parts, seeing the implications, explicating the implications, breaking down this unity of the term, to discover all terms in one term, and then to feel in the body the body's response to every part of the term used. Just as we've just seen, we can take three levels in the body of the I, Y, J, on the F, B, B, and so on. There are three levels that we can do these things in. And when we do, we will find a movement tendency in a part of the organism to express itself in a certain way. And when we allow this body movement to develop, we become aware of the significance of events which are impending in the field around us. One final little thing about the letter I, Y, J is that the same letter, you know, in the Hebrew we don't have the vowel forms written in the body of the word, they're added in later to finite the significance. Thus a consonantal structure in the Hebrew without the vowels has a very, very wide application, such that the rabbis can wring almost any meaning out of any term. And so this concept, Y, D, the vowel O, the yod, or the dot, or the yot, or the jot, the same jot or tittle which shall not pass away till all be fulfilled, this, with a simple vowel change from O to A, symbolizes yod, which is Hebrew for a hand, and symbolizes the creative manipulation of God's force. So that the point then has this other meaning, the means whereby God creates. That is to say that the absolute sentient power, which is the creative field itself, can only create by the precipitation of finite points of reference. And that once these are precipitated, it can do no more than integrate these precipitated points into various forms. And the means whereby it manipulates these existing points into various complex structures to create significance is simply the becoming aware, consciousness the catalyst. To look at the field of points and shift the attention in certain ways, like a Rorschach test, where you get your ink block and you see your grandmother in it, or worse, your mother-in-law, and whatever you see in it, it's in you, as well as in the block. In the same way, you take this absolute field, filled with points, and by simply looking in certain ways, you can abstract from the simultaneously presented infinity of points in the absolute whatever complex pattern you will to exist. And nothing constrains you other than your own will to see. And when you have will to see, at that moment of awareness, you crystallize a certain form. And because you are willing it, you are identified with it. And because you are identified with it, you have put yourself on the cross. That's a yod, or yod. And in so doing, you will have to pay the price of your own definition. Nobody can pay your prices for you. Nobody can impose a price on you that you don't want to pay. Even if the dearly beloved Queen sent an army now to bomb this room, if we get bombed, it's our fault for being here. And we have no ground of complaint, whatever happens. Because our final reply, if we don't like it, is to take the superstress off our individuated condition, which is called, of course, the right of self-murder, which has been recently considered as a possible new permissive attitude of government. When it says the Almighty has set his canon against self-slaughter, Baal is saying the absolute field will not allow any point to drop below the level of Allah's pressure. Allah is pressure, but it's the slightest pressure possible, consistent with any pressure whatever. And if we murder ourselves in the time process to escape it, and we bang ourselves into the subtle world is superstressed in a certain way. But if we try to murder ourselves in the subtle world, we will go into the causal world, and we cannot become less being than Allah's pressure. So our eternality as individuated beings is something that the absolute has attained. We can destroy ourselves out of the gross world by destroying our bodies. We can destroy ourselves out of the subtle world by destroying our minds. We cannot destroy ourselves out of the causal world, because that is will. And the will itself is a function of the continuum, and the continuum is eternal.
And always formulating.
And always formulating.
So really, every time you define it, you're obviously freeing and binding yourself simultaneously, eternally.
Yes, and there's a periodicity in this freeing and binding. This has to do with the problem of Peter and the keys again. Of course, Peter is simply Petros, which means the gross material stone, the stumbling block, which is the very foundation stone. Again, the point is the little stone, and that little stone is that upon which you stand in order to individuate. That brown stone that Barnabas complains about, you can't build with it. The only thing to do with it is chip it down until it's a bit flat on the edges and to start building with it. All good bricklayers know about this one. The state of individuation in its pure form is the round stone form, which is extremely difficult to build complex structures with. But this form here, created, is created by the absolute field and held in being by the absolute field at the Aleph level. If it tries to get rid of itself at the Aleph level, the effort of trying can never sink below Aleph level. Because trying is an effort, and the least conceivable effort is Aleph. So if it tries to drop below Aleph, it cannot, because its trying is a superstress. But if it accepts the Aleph pressure, it will continue to be an eternal being. So if it accepts itself as a vowel E, it is an alpha being. If it says, I will be Yah, that's a hey being. And if it says, I will say dia, that's a het being. It is putting a superstress and imposing upon itself levels of bondage and levels of responsibility, responsibility and responsibility, meaning liability to be punished by the type of definition self-imposed. 7:10. Dealing with Peter in the stone. Christ says to, would you like to read the passage out, Harry?
Yes. And I say also unto thee that thou art Peter.
Now, a little earlier, please. What's the question? If you start at that point, you're out of context. Christ says, whom do men say that I am?
Oh. And he said unto them, but whom say ye that I am? And Simon Peter answered and said, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus answered and said unto him, blessed art thou, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood hath not revealed it unto thee, but my Father which is in heaven. And I say also unto thee, that thou art Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. And I will give unto thee the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatsoever thou shalt bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatsoever thou shalt loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven.
Right. This is the famous passage used by the Catholics to justify a certain kind of apostolic succession and the idea that they have the keys of binding and loosening and whether you get into heaven or not. But Christ actually says here, whom do men say that I am? The disciples are there. Peter, not a verse is speaking up, says, no doubt you are the Almighty descended. Christ says straight away, flesh and blood have not revealed this, because flesh and blood, the individuated being, cannot reveal that which belongs peculiarly to the people. Thou art the Christ. This is a statement by Spirit. It is saying, here is the incarnation. And then Christ makes a fun about Peter's name. Peter means a rock and stone, translated by a good Anglican, stumbling block. And this rock is the material world. And because of this materiality at its greatest depth of degradation is the point at which you have to turn. Similar to Thomas putting his finger in the hole, the pure empirical research man. So here, this man identified with matter, as we see later in the Acts and in the quarrel about Peter and Paul, who is more important, and Paul's reply, who died for you, Peter, Paul, or Christ? The statement is made by Christ upon this rock, and he is not referring to Peter, the person. He's punning on this Peter name, which means a stone or rock. He is referring immediately to what Peter has said, thou art the Christ. He is God, this is his rock. Not Peter. Peter is named a rock. Christ has said, Simon, I shall call you Peter, a rock. It's a reference to his temperament. Christ says, this is the rock. I, says Christ, am the rock. And it is Christ we mean when we say the rock of ages. We do not mean Peter. But because Peter had come down to a certain level, when he was stimulated, whom do men say that I am? Whom do you say that I am? Now the Christ. At this point he says, aha, daylight is finally struck. And he says, and your name is rock, and upon this rock, not upon you. He doesn't say, upon you I will do this, yes, does he? Upon this rock, namely, that I am, this absolute I am now incarnate. Upon this I will build my church. But because you have seen it, I will give you the keys to bind and loose. Now what are these keys of binding and loosing? They're very simple ones. Now the keys of Saturn and Jupiter. Saturn is a defining force, centripetal. Jupiter is an undefining force. He says, if you can see this fact that somehow the absolute infinite has vested itself in the relative finite, if you can see this, you must have seen the implications of the Jupiter-Saturn opposition. This has been revealed to you not by flesh and blood, because that can't be revealed. This has been revealed to you from above. So when that intuition comes into you, you show that you can now accept what it means to define a limitation and what it means to undefine. That is, you posit, you imply, and then you explain. You can explicate the implications of terms. And we see then that from this idea, and not on any historical fact whatever related to Peter and Rome, because there isn't one, there is no establishment whatever that Peter was ever a pope in Rome, and therefore the apostolic succession does not derive in that way. The statement is made quite simply: Christ is the rock, and he has chosen an anti-rock opposite to himself as the material point upon which God, the Absolute, has stood. He has made the earth as a material particle as his footstool. In the same way, Christ has taken Peter as a muscle man, if you like. But he gives the keys of binding and loosing only in the sense of defining and of undefining. And it is upon this that the Roman Church bases its peculiar power, the ground of the infallibility of the Pope, to be infallible in matters of definition. See, the infallibility of the Pope is defined in such a way that it is only in matters of definition, of dogma and moral. Only in matters of definition that he is infallible. So these keys to the kingdom are the keys of definition and undefinition. Somebody comes to you and they say, I've done so and so and so and so, am I guilty? Now you have the power to say yes or no. You have the power to define the situation in such a way that you impose guilt. You have the power to undefine the definition that has already imposed guilt. And by means of this power to define, you can load somebody with guilt, or you can unload somebody already guilty. And these are the keys of binding and loosing. Let's see whether this is not necessarily true. It is said that God is all in all. There is nothing other than God. The absolute reality, God, is all there is. There is no other reality. For which reason, the apparent separativity of finite created beings within the universe cannot be an ultimate reality. So our individual existences, as separable existences, is untrue. There is nothing other than the absolute God. Here in this room are many, many centers of identification. And the identification is with finite forms by acts of will and by nothing else. There is an absolute sentient power field infinite. There is nothing else. All that we are modalities, actions, actualities, modifications of this absolute infinite field within it, by it, of it. So that any individual human being is simply a modal function of God, which is symbolized by the Genesis statement, God breathed his spirit into man, and man became a living soul. Now, this means to say that all separations whatever are absolutely untrue. There are no severances in the continuum of the absolute. All separation is an illusion, a myth. But it is an illusion created by defining activities. There is no lost soul other than the soul which believes itself lost through identification with the definition. Because there is only the absolute continuum, therefore lostness in the sense of severance from the good, if we accept a theological definition of sin as missing the mark, or sin as separation from God, this separation is an utter impossibility. There is no possibility whatever of anybody being separated in any way other than by error of thought caused by false definition. But the actual essential identity of that formal function of the individual with the infinite sentient power of God at that point, that actual identification that keeps him in being is a possibility. But if he superstresses it and defines it as if it were severable, and if you could cut it off and isolate it with a vacuum between it and God, if you could do that, then sin would be a possibility. But this is an absolute impossibility. We cannot sever the continuum. And therefore it is said that the person who understands the nature of the seamless garment to Christ, and is said the nature of the continuum, that it cannot be severed, because the continuum has no parts. And therefore, whether we know it or not, we participate within God, that is, within the absolute sentient power. And therefore, anybody who believes that incarnation is possible, and this statement is made, that the infinite can modalize itself as if it were actually finite. Anybody who can believe that the infinite can finite itself in act, that is, function as if it were several instead of just a unifield, anybody who can believe that believes in the incarnation. And if he believes in this way, the incarnation of Christ is no mystery to him. And consequently, at the moment he believes in this, he believes in what Christ meant. And therefore, he knows that this concept, the Christ concept of the possibility of the incarnation, is absolutely saving. That the man who can see what Christ meant when he made this statement, when he said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life," etc. When he made this statement, the man who can see it immediately, that is, without mediation, is saved absolutely. Because he cannot get lost. He can fool about and kick over the traces like St. Paul did after he'd seen it. He can behave as if he was separate, but he cannot believe that he is separate anymore. St. Paul didn't. He still behaved as if he was, but he couldn't believe it because he had seen the truth. Now, as soon as we see this truth, we have the power to bind or loose any concept whatever upon any person whatever, because we have the power to define. And if a person comes along and says, "I am guilty," we have the power to say, "Yea, yea, you are guilty," or, "No, no, you are not guilty." We will redefine it for you. We will find out in what way it is you think you are guilty. And guilt is the will crucified. Guilt means neither more nor less than the belief that we're in a position whereby we can be punished. Guilt is the psychological state of the expectancy of punishment, and it is nothing else. So if somebody comes along and says, "I feel guilty," we can say, "You mean you are expecting punishment?" We can so define guilt that the fellow can see the logic of it. "Yes, well, of course, I feel guilty because I've done so and so, and the Gentiles are already coming down the street to get me." And then you can say, "Yes, you are liable to be punished because of what you have done there on your trail." In other words, you can fix it. You can say, "Yes, yes, true." But supposing a person comes along and says, "I'm guilty," you say, "What have you done?" He says, "Nothing, I'm just guilty." Now, people do come along very, very often with a feeling of guilt that has nothing to do with them at all. It is a feeling that has arisen that punishment is impending, and it is a feeling that has been taken over from another person by identification. Thus, if a mother behaves badly, and she's got a child on her knee, and perhaps daddy's out of work, and the gas man has just come in and pecked her on the ear lovingly and given her threatened tobacco or something, she feels guilty. "What would daddy say if he saw this tooth mark on my ear?" Now the child does not know what this is, but empathically, that is, feeling into the mother, he feels terrible. And he feels impending doom, but he doesn't know what about. Later on, a situational stimulus can make that child expect to be punished, without him having the faintest idea of why. And he can come along, 30 years old, and say, "I feel terrible. I feel I've sinned against the world, and I don't know what about, but I've got this upon me." And so we look at it and we examine the situation and we say, not guilty. We have the power to undefine his guilt, to delimit it so that he isn't guilty. It isn't his guilt. He has appropriated the guilt of another person in the empathic relation. So that by simply understanding the nature of definition, we can in fact impose on a person, that is, a person who hasn't the same power, the operators and the things again, we can impose on a person a superstress to continue his state of guilt, or we can impose on him another viewpoint that removes his guilt. And this is a power that not Peter only, but any person whatever receives immediately he understands the nature of definition and the nature of the continuum and the absolute sentient power. So that when this argument is presented to us about the authority of God being vested through Christ in his vicar on earth, etc., when we see that the ground of the statement is a passage of the order of this, whom do men say that I am, and so on, so on, so on, so on, and then upon thou art Peter, which means a rock, and upon this rock will I build my church. This rock that he refers to, what he refers to is that I am the incarnate God. That is the rock. And therefore the title Rock of Ages, cleft for me, refers to Christ, not to Peter. Peter is not the rock upon which the church is founded. Nor is Peter said to be the rock of ages in any religious doctrine of Christianity, whatever, including Catholicism. The rock of ages, even in Catholicism, is Christ, not Peter. And therefore the interpretation of this particular passage requires the reading of the whole passage, and we should not allow someone to come along and say, we have the authority of Christ here because he says, thou art Peter, and I will give you the keys, etc., etc. Let's go back to the beginning of the passage and start, whom do men say that I am? And then we will come to the true conclusion and understand the meaning of definition and how factually definition means limitation in position. And that when you define a situation in the presence of other beings, you are actually imposing upon them, and in so doing, imposing upon yourself. When Christ says, if you do it to the least of these little ones, meaning the ones not ready to define accurately, you do it to me, because me, Christ. Because they are precipitated centers willed through the macrocosmic Christ into existence. So if you find a person who has no power to define, and therefore is a child, relative to this power, if you then proceed to impose on him a false definition, you put yourself wrong absolutely with Christ, with the macrocosmic sphere. And straight away, because each man is a macrocosm with all his parts in correspondence with the macrocosm, in putting yourself wrong with the macrocosmic Christ through imposing a known erroneous definition on a defenseless ignoramus, you impose on the corresponding part in yourself, and the definition you have imposed on that other person is now imposed on the correspondent idea group in yourself, which then proceeds to act independently, determined by your erroneous definition, and produces a series of faulty judgments in yourself, such that you have to pay the price of your own definition. And therefore, he says, it would be better for you, rather than do this, to put a millstone around your neck and get yourself thrown in the sea. The sea there means chaos, the return to psychic indifferentiation. And if you once make a false definition, that definition will grind like the mills of God. That false definition, knowingly made, will accrete to itself, to fit into itself, all the other definitions there are, and constrain them like Humpty Dumpty's vocabulary, to its will. And then the whole being will be carried along and falsely integrated by this false definition. and then the whole man will pay the price, just as if he had put the millstone round his neck and thrown himself into the sea of chaos.